Welcome to the Going to Seed podcast. I'm your host, Shane Simonson, and today we are talking to Revelsaur. And I do not know quite where to start with an introduction about what he's doing, so I think I will get Revel to do it himself. So please, can you tell us about your background and the work that you're doing at the moment?
Hi, Shane. How are you doing? So my name is Revelsaur, and I'm Australian, but I've done a lot of work between Australia and Indonesia, and also more over in Papua now as well. So, but I guess a little bit about my background is, you know, I've been growing things since I was very young. So when I was, you know, around nearly five, I think my parents got me to grow some parsley because I wanted to earn some pocket money. So I started that. That's the way I learned how to germinate seeds for the first time, you know, growing parsley and selling little bunches of it down at the health food shop for 50 cents. And then that got me interested in growing seeds, and I proceeded to sprout every kind of seed in the house for the next 10 years. So like I'll go through the pantry and pick out, you know, the lentils and the chickpeas and every kind of fruit that came into the house. I'd try and see if there's a seed in it and try and germinate it. And so, yeah, started very young. And then I got into permaculture when I was about 18. I was introduced by my grandmother and helped build gardens for them. And then that got me into studying when I went to Geraldton. I studied at the Drylands Permaculture Institute with Julie Firth when I was interning there. And then I went to university in Perth. And eventually, basically, I ended up going to study tropical ecology and conservation in Townsville. And I used that when I went overseas to Indonesia to start doing like large-scale rehabilitation projects. And basically I was always working with traditional farmers. And so I took my interest of seeds with me to that. And yeah, got to see both sides, got to see like what's actually really happening out there in the world when it comes to, you know, seed genetics. And at the moment I'm working in West Papua. We've got some projects there where we're doing the land rehabilitation in an agroecological way. So we're basically taking degraded land and turning it back into productive traditional agroforestry.
Brilliant, brilliant. And you use quite a lot of syntropic principles in your projects, I believe.
Yes. We're adapting the syntropic model, which originally comes from Brazil, but it's sort of routed through Australia. So I learned it in Australia. So it's been modified here to, you know, use more machinery and just like different species and slightly different approaches. And I'm taking that to Papua to adapt to there, because as you know, Australia and Papua are essentially one landmass, just with a little moat in between, you know.
Yeah.
It was 10,000 years ago, there was one piece of land. And so the biology is very similar.
Mm. Now, for our audience who may not be familiar with syntropic agriculture, could you give us an overview about like what its main aims and principles are? Like what's the core idea behind syntropic agriculture?
Okay, so that's an interesting one. But I guess if you put it into just simple terms, it's a low input form of agriculture. So instead of focusing on what we need to put into the agriculture, it uses the processes, biological processes to build fertility. So rather than say, analyzing your soil and go, oh, we have to put N, P, and K into the soil, we're rather looking at, okay, what stages does the growth pattern have to go through to raise the fertility of the soil? Because quite often the soil has all the nutrients in it already, but because it's in a low state of life processes, like it's kind of degraded and doesn't have much carbon, there's not much biological processes happening in the soil, all that nutrition is not available. So what we're trying to do is start with plants that will easily grow in the conditions as they are, and then manage those through cycles of pruning and growth to basically build up the soil profile, build up soil quality so that other things are able to grow.
Brilliant. Yeah, that's exactly how I had started to get a sense of it. And it's very much about, correct me if I've got this wrong, it's about integrating diverse plant families into structured plantings and then managing their growth cycles in order to bring that soil back into maximum productivity.
Yes, it's definitely, it's a system of production. That's no doubt about that. You use it to produce something from from the land. And yeah, we're basically using the two models. We've got the different layers of different life cycles in succession, and then we have the different strata. So we're trying to fill the different strata that occupy different amounts of light. So you have maximum photosynthesis, and then we're trying to engage that over time by moving through cycles of succession. So you move from plants of a low needs, and then they create the conditions for plants that need higher nutrition be able to grow. And you just sort of keep on cycling, and you're stepping up each time.
Yeah, it's a brilliant system, and I think it's one I need to look into more and learn a little bit more about. I think my ice cream bean alleys that I use for growing crops are a very primitive equivalent of what the potential is in centropic agriculture with using a wider diversity of species that are interplanted.
Yeah, and I think, you know, the ideas these days, they're converging. So you have, for example, you have centropic coming in it from one angle, and then you have like Dr. Christine Jones coming in it with her multi-species cover cropping. And they're basically the same thing, except Christine Jones hasn't got the perennial system happening really with the trees and everything. But what you've got is not many different species of family, different layers of strata, all working together and creating a much more diverse bacterial microbiome, which is what's doing the work anyway. So yeah, I think we're all converging on this truth, central
yes.
truth.
Yeah, and if you study pre-industrial farming systems in detail, they were often very similar to what we're aiming for. They had these degrees of interweaving and complexity and sensitive management of all of the species. Like there was a relationship with all the species in that system. But I mean, that takes a lot of training and time and attention, something that mechanized farming just kind of rode over the top of and cut out all of the complexity.
Absolutely. I mean, when I go to Papua,
whenever I go to these different ethnic groups, whether I'm in the highlands or the lowlands or different areas, they all have different styles of gardening. Most are based on like slash and burn. In fact, no, they're all based on slash and burn. But there's a lot of variation between farmers. And sometimes you have these really old, successful farmers, which probably goes hand in hand, being old and successful. And yeah, they have a very skilled way of doing this slash and burn. So they're not burning all the organic matter. You know, they'll burn it, they'll wait till the leaves fall off. They'll only burn the hardwood, but they'll keep the leaves and spread that back across the surface. And so, you know, when I go over there, I'm learning just as much from them as they get from me. But I just go over there with basically I look for the things they're not able to solve themselves.
Yeah.
Right. And then just try and do that. I'm not going to go over there. And I said to them, I'm not going to tell you how to forest garden. Like, I'm coming here to learn what you do. But obviously, if you've got things that you don't know how to fix, then yeah, ask me and I'll try and help you figure them out.
Would you guess that Papua is one of the most intact pre-industrial agricultural cultures left on the planet?
Oh, without doubt. Yeah, certainly in this hemisphere.
There's areas there where people have barely any contact with the outside world. Like, and often when they are, it's forced.
Yeah.
So, for example, if you're up in the Central Highlands, if you were to try and travel overland from the coast to the Central Highlands, it would take you 2 months by road, right? And it's not that far, but it's just, it is wild, wild country. Yeah. So there's this system of subsidized transport because of the mining up there, where they have like 50 747s arriving every day.
Wow.
And they carry everything, like cars. The bitumen for the roads was carried by plane.
Wow.
So that just shows the scale of the forcing. So basically, if there was any interruption to that supply, everything would just fall back to the way it was. And that's exactly what happened during COVID. I was just up there in the highlands and I was talking to people, what happened during COVID? And they said, well, just not much, really. We just went back to doing what we always did.
So it's comforting to know, sorry, after you.
I was just going to say, this is the final point there. I've got a friend who works in development up there, and he basically said, you know, if the world ever ended, then like Melanesia would just keep going. You know, it's the part of the world that where if the rest of the world just disappeared, they would just, yeah, they'd probably miss their phones and their instant noodles. But yeah, they wouldn't notice much otherwise.
They'd muddle along. It's such a contrast to have Papua New Guinea right next to Australia, where I like to think that we've gone from hunter-gatherer to industrial agriculture with almost nothing in between. So if we lose industrial agriculture, what are we going to do? Like we're starting from almost nothing as a foundation. So that's what motivates me to do a lot of my work.
It's me too. And it also, you know, I'm bridging these two worlds here. I'm in Australia and I'm also in West Papua. So they're very different settings. And when I go to West Papua, it's easier to do work there because they already know they're what do they say, ethnobotanically literate. So people know what all the food crops look like. Usually they have some experience in how to plant them, how to use them. You know, these guys, you give them a knife and they'll build you a house, you know, in the jungle out of sticks and bamboo. And then you come back to Australia and say it's difficult here because you really have to start in a difficult economic setting with people with very little survival knowledge.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Yeah. It's remedial gardening for like the first 10 years.
Yeah, it's like teaching people how to eat things that they can grow.
Now, getting on to the usual focus of the Going to Seed podcast, normally at this point I ask, what was the path that led you to crop breeding? But do you do much crop breeding work? And do the people in Papua that you work with have a culture of breeding and selecting crops? Like, how does that work?
Okay, so I'm definitely doing some crop breeding work, but mostly in Australia so far. And I'm working with like a variety of things, which we'll talk about. Over in Papua, though, there's not much of a culture of planting from seed. So almost this is part of where I'm coming into this, is I'm bringing new seeds and new trees. So they have a system of slash and burn, where they will basically take an area of healthy forest, cut it down, let it dry, burn it down to the ashes and the charcoal, and then plant their crops. But they'll only farm there for 1 year, and then move on. Now, even though they say it's only 1 year, it's actually a little bit longer because they'll plant some things that will continue on for the next few years. So like bananas, papayas, all these kinds of things. But then pretty much the soil is not as fertile anymore and they'll move on. But they don't plant much from seed. It's mostly like divisions of like cassava, cocoa yam, taro, sweet potato, sugarcane, banana. And there's a few things like, you know, chilies and peanuts. And what else is there? Papayas, they come from seed. But yeah, it's a lot of vegetatively propagated crops. Oh, of course, the hibiscus spinach is one of their favorite, the ibica.
And it seems to be a universal trend that there were periods of domestication where growers and farmers must have been growing things from seed to go through those early processes of selection and domestication. And then somewhere along the road, they ended up with enough crops that grew fine from clones that they just kind of lost that habit. They lost those foundational skills of like domesticating new species and improving by sexual selection. And I think you can see that's happened in multiple places around the world. And it's just interesting to contemplate if there would be benefits in reversing that, of like rekindling this engine of domestication that humans are very capable of doing.
I think that the potential there is huge. I mean, like bananas, for example, are one which, I mean, Papua is almost like the center, one of the centers of diversity of banana. There's debate as to whether it's actually the origin of the cultivated banana. And it probably is in a way. It's probably like it was domesticated in a few different places, but certainly in Papua, the diversity is the north coast of the whole island. So it includes Papua New Guinea and West Papua. Very, very diverse banana cultivars. And of course, they tend to mutate from sports. But yeah, there's also a lot of seeded bananas up there, and some of the cultivated bananas, you'll find seeds inside them. But I guess one of the things I'm finding up there is that harvesting and storing seeds on the equator is very difficult.
Yes.
It's that constant humidity, and how you're going to store things, and everything goes moldy, and the constant insects. But yeah, it's just that fact that it can be raining one day and then the next day it's sunny and it's completely dry again. Because you have very high rainfall, but then you have this really intense tropical sun. So if you don't have forest cover, the land just dries out super fast. And so when you're trying to do, especially an annual crop, it has to be very hardy. You know, maybe you definitely do cowpeas. Cowpeas and mung beans are doing well. And we can harvest seeds from the cowpeas, but the mung beans, they turn moldy before we can harvest them.
Yep. So, I mean, even where I'm in the subtropics, if we have a proper humid summer, then many crops are just not viable. Like, you can't get them to complete their life cycle without rotting on the plant.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah.
I had that too in Northern South Wales, the sort of extended wet autumns that we have. It's just a nightmare for like harvesting seed. I'm always like struggling trying to get the seed dry before it molds out.
It's why I'm particularly interested in finding crops that we can plant in the middle of those wet autumns that ripen in the winter when it's more reliably dry. And there's so few things that I've found that have that potential that also fit in with all the other constraints here. So I'm
Well,
hopeful
the
I'll.
lima beans are doing that.
Yeah,
The lima
lima
beans are
beans are
doing that for me
great.
now. Yeah, because they're maturing now when it's already dried off a bit. I'm talking about New South Wales now. I'm trying to grow lima beans in Papua as well because they're not something that is there. But okay, so they have these gardens, but they move around all the time. I'm going to jump backwards and forwards a bit.
That's
So I've got
fine.
these gardens in Papua where they have to move around in the forest all the time. Now, because people keep pigs over there in the village and the pigs are free ranging, people can't do any gardens near their homes. So they have to walk several kilometers over to the forest before they get to their gardens. And they have to do this like every day.
Interesting. See,
Yeah, because, yeah, in the world, there's.
I would have guessed it would be the other way around, that you'd keep the gardens close and let the animals go further out, but I guess there'd be a good chance of them never coming back if they go too far.
Could be that there's wild pigs out there anyway, but they're sort of they're like a free-for-all for hunting. But the pigs that you have in the garden, sorry, the pigs from the village, they're very expensive. They're like a different breed. They're like a gray color or different. They have, the domestication syndrome, so they have different patterns, whereas like a wild type tends to be just the single color. But anyway, they're very expensive, and over there they're used as currency. So if you do something wrong in society and you have to pay a fine to somebody, it's usually paid in pigs or equivalent of a pig. And so the current price of a pig in the area I'm working in, Kebar, it's about 5 million Indonesian rupiah, which is about $500 for a pig. Yeah. And once you go up into the Central Highlands, so in Wamena, it's 35 million or $3,500 per pig. So that's like big money, and if you get a fine of 50 pigs, that's like $25,000 in Kebar. It's a pretty serious thing that you've done. But so basically these pigs are very valuable and they keep them around the house. But it's one of those cultures, you have these cultures in the world, you have fence in cultures and fence out cultures. And so in Papua, it's definitely a fence out culture. So if you want to protect something from livestock, you have to fence it. It's up to you to keep the pigs out.
And before cheap barbed wire fencing, that was the culture pretty much everywhere.
Yep, that's right. And over there they haven't. Okay, so because I worked in other parts of Indonesia, I picked up different techniques that they use there. So if one of them was living fencing, which is really well developed in the central part of Indonesia, so Lombok, Sumbawa, and Bali and parts of Java. And so I took that the idea there. It's just a concept. They had all the materials already, and I said, I basically just made it more secure, hog tight, and that's working really well. We did that out in on the islands in Raja Ampat. And now I'm taking it up into Kebar, where we put a garden of living sticks. You'd be familiar with some of those, like Gliricidia has been very famous, used in South America, Central America. But there's at least, I'd say at least 100 species of tree that you can use. You cut off a stick, you put it in the ground, it will grow again. And because otherwise, what happens is I've seen in places where when they do traditional fencing, they use dead wood. And because of the tropical climate or equatorial climate, which is
Doesn't
even
last
more
long.
intense, doesn't last. It lasts much less than it takes to grow, and so you end up with net deforestation. Whereas by using the living fencing, you basically, you can actually, after a while, your fence gets too tall, you cut it down, you've got more stakes to extend the fence.
It's brilliant. Would you say that the Papuan agroecological system, particularly in the highlands, is protein limited? Is that like the
Very
most
much.
scarce resource, and that's why the pigs
Very
are so
much.
central as a commodity?
They are, but you hardly ever see, if I ever see pork for sale or being eaten, it's always wild pig, like feral pig. They eat a lot more deer, which they hunt. It's mostly wild meats that they're eating, apart from a few imported chickens that come up on the transports. But the domestic pigs, they're rarely eaten because they're so valuable. They're a literal piggy bank. That's how you store your wealth as a pig. And I've seen this in Lombok. They store them as goats. You have a goat bank, or in other places in Africa, it's a cattle. Your wealth is judged by how many cattle you have. So in Papua, it's the pig bank. So people are often surrounded by livestock like pigs, but still protein deficient.
Yeah, because they have to save it for a rainy day or a disaster.
Yeah, or it belongs to one person and not the others.
Yeah,
you know, and it's part of their status.
Do you think there's any potential for other kinds of livestock that haven't been introduced into Papua New Guinea yet? Like maybe calves from South America, the proper meat calves?
That's something I do intend to
do that, yes. So that you can get those in other parts of Indonesia in the pet trade.
Mm-hmm.
And what I'm trying to do is, because Papua is a special province with special quarantine rules, so it's very difficult to bring animals in. It's impossible to bring any bird because Papua has such a high diversity of birds, and so there's special quarantine rules for it. But what I want to find out is if anybody keeps pets, because there are some coastal cities, and I really want to get hold of those guinea pigs. And I think as a way to introduce it, I'm not going to turn up and say, here's these guinea pigs, you know, eat them. I'll be like, first of all, we're going to bring them in as a manure factory.
Yeah.
So because there's hardly any livestock up there. You have pigs which are free ranging. You've got a few cows that are free ranging, and so there's no way to collect the manure.
Yeah.
And so
yeah,
when
yeah,
you're
yeah.
trying to, part of the reason we're doing this low input agriculture is because there are no inputs. Everything is so dispersed that there is nothing. Even if you wanted to, you couldn't buy it.
Exactly.
Which is where we'll probably end up in a post-industrial agriculture. It's like, yeah, you got money, so what? There's nothing here.
I see so much untapped potential in the proper productive South American genetics of guinea pigs, because the fancy varieties, the little tiny, like pretty looking ones, you could start with that and try to breed it back towards something larger and more productive, but it would be so much work. And importing live animals into Australia from overseas now, you're looking at like $10,000, even for a small animal like guinea pigs. But I'm hopeful that someone will do it at some point, because it's such a
we'll have to crowdfund it once we
that
we'll
well
have to
exactly
crowdfund it eventually.
Well, here's the thing with small animals like that, because they reproduce so rapidly, within 5 years, if you have a successful import, everybody could like get their starting, you know, pair of guinea pigs, and suddenly you've got a whole new industry and culture and form of livestock. So if Papua can do it, then we can do it.
Yes. Well, the reason why I think it's going to be the guinea pigs is really interesting up there in the highlands is that they already keep rabbits, but at higher elevations. So when they're up around 2,000 meters altitude, you can keep rabbits up there and they do well.
Yeah.
But we're only at about 600 meters, which is still quite tropical. We're cool enough to grow some cool stuff so we can grow presumably we can grow apples and durians next to each other.
Wow.
Yeah. So you can have a low chill apple, like an Anna, next to a durian, and they'll both be happy because we're in that sweet spot at around 600 meters on
That's
the
it.
equator.
That's it. I'm moving to Papua New Guinea.
Yeah. It's beautiful. I really do love it there. But yeah, it's still too hot for rabbits. Still too hot. They don't like it. But also, one of the most popular meats in the local area is bandicoot.
Ah, yes. Yeah.
Right? Which, for the other listeners not from Australia, it's a little marsupial. It's a sort of rabbit-sized marsupial. And over there, they call it tikus tana, which is just the Indonesian term, means like earth rat.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not actually a rat. It's a marsupial. And it's a really popular meat. Tastes a bit mix of, like, what we say, duck and pork, I think. It's got that rubbery skin like pork, but inside it's kind of the duck, but no fat on it. It's like a lean duck, because I think like a lot of those small animals, they keep their fat inside the viscera, inside the body.
Yep.
It's not in the muscle. Or actually, and also they have the fat just under the skin.
Yeah.
Anyway, so they're already eating these small animals, and so it's like, yeah, guinea pig is a good option.
Just one of these things I'm like always whispering in people's ears, because I've got my hands full here. Oh, and while I think of it too, and this is again me hijacking the conversation, do you think there's potential for bunya nut and its relatives in Papua?
I already took it. It's
Oh,
already there.
Brilliant. Brilliant. You beat
Yeah,
me
yeah.
to
So,
it.
So the local area, when you look up on the, okay, so we're in this Kebar Valley, which is about 600 meters altitude. But then there's two mountain ranges either side, and they both go up to about 1,000 meters. And so when you look up the hill, you see all these Araucaria cunninghamii, the hoop pines, growing all along the ridge lines. And they tend to basically grow where the clouds, you have cloud forest up there. So where the cloud comes, they'll catch the cloud and make it drip. And they collect water up there by themselves.
Yep.
And I saw those, and the Dutch had brought, when the Dutch were there, they had a research station in Kebar Valley. And they brought seeds down from the highlands and planted them in block formations down on the valley floor. And they did really well, and they build amazing soil.
Mm.
It's really beautiful black soil that's under them now. And so, oh, okay, well, we better bring some bunya nuts. So the season was on in Australia, and someone gave me some. I took them over there and planted them, and now we have about 40 trees.
Brilliant.
Now, this is like an intergenerational gift. It'll be like,
exactly,
because there's no mature ones around, it's going to be 20 years before yep. anything happens.
Yep. Well, if you in the future want more diverse bunya genetics, so you're not bottlenecking with your founding population, I'll be going back to all the remnant trees next time we have a massing year, and you would be a perfect candidate to send that next installment of genetic diversity, so you get a real population.
That's amazing. And I mean, I was trying to get hold of some seeds from North Queensland as well.
Yes.
But the person who had them, they wanted $20 a seed.
Oh my God.
And I was like, I couldn't really do that right now.
I have some of them in my population. They are quite different, but I think there's 10 times more diversity in the southeast corner if you know where to look for it. So, yeah.
Yeah, I think bunya nuts are really, really good because they're part of the Australasian ecology and they suit the Papuan taste, I think. They're like, because they taste like a sweet potato, sort of a chestnutty flavor. Yep. And, you know, they love their sweet potatoes and root crops over there. So I think, yeah, it'd be perfect.
Brilliant. Do you want to talk a little bit more about the crops that you're growing and breeding? Like what projects are standing out that you're working on here in Australia? Though, if you're only here half the time, that's going to be interesting juggling that as well. It probably favors low input, hands-off kind of crops.
Oh, well, the land I'm living on in New South Wales, I mean, I bought this 20 something years ago, and I basically planted a whole lot of things here and then just left for 10 years. And so, you know, it has this history of being left, and that's part of the strategy that I'm using here. So on this block, which is 1 acre in Tabulum, New South Wales, I'm aiming for 500 different species of plants on this 1 acre.
Wow.
And the reason why I'm doing that is because I basically looked at what is that of diversity of a lowland tropical rainforest in you know, per unit area. And it's pretty much the same across all three continents, like Africa, Asia, and the Americas. And it works out to, you know, I have 1 acre, so around about 500 species would put me up there in that range. So it's just like pulled that out of the ether. Went, okay, let's go for that. I'm getting there. I think there's about 350 species growing on this in my garden at the moment. So that includes like support species as well as all the food crops and herbs and things like that. Over in Papua, we've got about 142 types of fruit trees already, and we haven't really started yet. That was just the commonly available stuff. Yeah. So yeah, in Australia, I'm working on, I guess there's three groups. There's the warm season, the cool season, and the perennial.
Mm-hmm.
So, and then I split those into, I can't put all my attention on, you know, you've only got so much attention to spend. So I split them into categories as well. There's the ones which are like I'm really focused on. There's the ones which are pending, which are still, you know, I've collected all the seeds, but they haven't nowhere to grow them out yet.
Mm.
And then there's sort of the orphan crops where I can't find enough genetic diversity to even really get started.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
I'm sure you're familiar with that.
I've got exactly that same pattern here.
So I guess in the warm season, I'm working with maize, corn. And the first thing I wanted to do is just breed some colored corn. Just something that was robust. So I got some glass gem popcorn and I crossed it with African dent maize. And then I crossed that with a Harkin green dent. So, and I've ended up with some really wild colors in dent corn. So it was really interesting to see what color genetics you can pull out of glass gem, which is a really good starter.
Mm.
And I'm working with okra because I do like okra, especially when it's barbecued. People think it's slimy, but if you basically just coat it in oil and salt and put it on the barbecue, it's not slimy anymore. It's really tasty. So just mixing them all up together. And then I've collected all the different, every single kind of common bean I could find in Australia. So, and then split them into, what was it, three, four groups. So it's like your pole dry beans, your pole green beans, your bush green and your bush dry beans. So I've got four populations. I've only managed to grow out two of those so far, which was the pole dry and the bush dry. And just basically planting them all together and hoping that they'll cross-pollinate naturally. And then basil. I had a big problem in Australia and in Indonesia with there's a disease called basil downy mildew.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure if you've come across it.
Yes, yeah. I started growing Prospera, I think was one of the strains.
Right. Yes,
yeah. That had some resistance.
Right. I got some of the seed off you. Yeah, so what I've done is I've taken the same varieties that you started with, and then I'm mixing them with all the other types of Genovese basil that I can find, and hoping that any of them can survive the disease until they get to cross with the resistant strain. And so I can create a grex of, yeah, the resistant strain cross with whatever other pollen donors it can get from all the other types that are around.
Yeah, because I found Prospera to be acceptable, but it's still not a great leaf basil at its,
yeah, that's
its
right.
fullest
so
potential.
I want to basically mix that. And it's also, you know, there's other resistance too. It's not just basil downy mildew. There's fusarium and there's all sorts of other things. So I just wanted to put all together, mix it all up, and just cycle it through the wash a few times and then see what comes out after two or three generations. Yeah. And that's part of my strategy as well. Just at the moment, I'm really in the mixing phase. I've done a lot of collecting. Now I'm doing mixing, and then we'll basically let nature do the selection for us. And then in a few generations down the line, then I'll start doing taste tests.
Brilliant.
Well, I'll start tasting it now, but I'll start selecting for taste in a few generations.
Yeah. You definitely have to get the vigor settled first, and then you can start putting the screws on them to weed out the ones that aren't worth eating.
And, you know, especially since I'm here and I'm in Papua half the time and here half the time, I can't have any crops that require babying, really. I have to basically plant it with this, you know, whatever the season says, it's time to plant it now. We plant those, and then they'll be left alone until I come back, and then I'm hoping for a harvest.
Does your family pick the okra when you're away? That's the one thing I really don't like about okra, is you have to pick it every bloody day, or the pods just get out of control.
Well, basically, they're not allowed to yet. I'm like, no, that's my seed crop.
That makes sense.
But this year, we're going to have enough of the mixed seed that I would just plant two separate plots. One is my seed crop, and the other one is for the family vegetable patch.
Brilliant.
And that goes with, I mean, things like, for example, the pumpkins is fine, because the pumpkins and watermelons, because you harvest them when they're mature. But I had a problem this summer with my family picking all the cucumbers while I was away. I was like, no, my cucumbers, you know, so, and yeah, I have to make sure I plant two patches.
I might beg some of that mixed okra seed off you to save me from having to build my own grex, because I've just given up on Rosella. It's been inconsistent and unproductive enough that I'm like, and I tried hybridizing, hand crossing my two distinct strains, and they're incompatible. There's probably some chromosome difference between them. So I'm like, no, I've got nothing.
Well, you
to
just
work
saved me some time.
Yeah, I've got nothing.
You just
to
saved
work
me
with.
Some time then, because I was trying to do exactly the same thing.
Yeah,
and I had a terrible year for Rosella. We had some really bad hailstorms like about a month ago, and it just destroyed the plants. As a strong selective pressure, that one.
Yeah. And I made my last batch of Rosella jam, and I'm like, never again. It's like, it's had its chance. And I think I'm going to go back to okra for that Malvaceae family and just deal with having to pick it regularly. I've got a couple of other summer crops that are the same, so I'm out there anyway.
Well, the thing I like about the okra is it's kind of a meaty vegetable. If you know how to cook it in a way that you like, it gives that bulk.
Yeah.
And quite often, you know, that's a thing that's lacking, is you just need something that's going to fill you up, that's, you know, vegetable.
I also appreciate any summer vegetable that quickly gets above waist height, so that all of the common weeds that are just inevitably going to get away at some point during the season over summer when you get a bit of rain, it gets to get head and shoulders above them. And it's not a critical issue to keep those weeds meticulously clean.
Yeah, that's what I'm looking for too. Vigor is really important, because in summertime, same sort of setting, the weeds just go wild. So I want things that are going to climb over the weeds. In the cool season, it's different though. Oh, sorry, go on.
I was just going to quickly ask about sword beans, Cannavalia, because I know they're used quite extensively in Indonesia, but do the Papuans use them as well?
No, I've taken jack beans, the white one.
Yeah,
not the red one.
They're the most domesticated one.
Yeah, I've taken the white one over there, and we use them extensively in the syntropic agroforestry. And so they're completely new to them. They haven't seen them before. And they said, you know, can we eat them? And I said, no.
Well,
because
kind
I,
of, yeah.
I, yeah, exactly. And it's like, if I give them something that makes them sick, it's like, that's a bad thing.
They lose their trust
So
in
I
you,
have to...
yeah.
Yeah, I have to use the precautionary principle here. and just say no for now. And then later on, once I figure it out, find out what, you know, from the people who do eat them, okay, what are the details and how we process them?
Yeah.
Then I can come back and say, well, if you do this, then they're edible. But they're certainly not edible in their raw state.
Yeah, I suspect you could boil them once and feed them to pigs, because pigs are really good at turning their nose up at something if they don't want it. And their digestion is much stronger than humans. They can deal with that little bit of residual alkaloid. Like, we have to boil and change the water like multiple times to get it to a point where it's fine. But maybe it would be useful as pig food because it's got a lot of protein in it.
I did run into some Papuans at one point who were familiar with the bean. They must have seen it before. And I said, you know, is it edible? And they said, no, but if you eat like five seeds, you'll get drunk. So some kind of toxicity there, which is obviously, they use the term mabuk, which is like, it's Indonesian for just like drunk or intoxicated.
Yep.
So I was like, I don't definitely want to tell women and children that they can eat these beans. So I say, no, these are not for eating. These are just for planting to make the soil more fertile. So whenever you plant a banana tree, you plant the jack beans around it and it helps the banana grow.
I'm very keen to learn how to use jack beans for tempeh, because I think cooking and changing the water once and then a fermentation process is a more energy efficient way of getting that last little bit of alkaloid out. Because I've read that they do that quite extensively in Indonesia with the jack beans.
Yeah, that would make sense. I'll try that. I'm having problems in New South Wales getting the jack bean to mature.
Oh, you might be just a little bit too cool.
Too cool, yeah. And that is an issue out here. We get these hot summer days, and then maximum temperature is like 18 degrees at night. And as you go into autumn, it gets cooler. And things just, you know, one of the things I'll be selecting for with my populations is that ability to mature before the heat disappears.
Yeah.
It's not really cold yet, it's just not warm enough.
I will definitely send you a seed of my hybrid three-way crazy mix of sword beans, and you can like grow some of them out and see which ones actually mature well for you, given your climate patterns.
That would be fantastic, because they grow well.
They grow well. They just won't finish. Yeah.
Yeah. Just
yeah. So at the moment, I'm into the cool season.
Yeah. Tell us about your cool season.
As I said, the cool season is, I'm not really working on too many cool season crops because some of them require a lot of effort and care. But what I'm going to do is just get control of these easy ones. So dill, coriander, parsley, carrot, parsnip. These things basically self-seed for me here. They really match. They match the climate. They'll grow well. But what I'm finding, especially things like dill and carrot and parsley, actually, the selections we have available in Australia are just not vigorous enough. They're not as vigorous as I remember them being in the past. And so what I've done is just taken every kind of dill I can find, every kind of coriander, every kind of carrot, parsley, parsnip, mix them all together, and they're just trying to create some grapes to start with.
Yeah. That's pretty much the only option we have. I'm doing the same with cumin this year. So I'll get you some seed off that. Nice. A lot of the seed in trade here is dead. I suspect they repackage it from like culinary seed that's been like oven baked and just pass it off to unsuspecting buyers. Finocchio fennel is probably worth thinking about as well, because you get the leaves, well, you get the thinnings, then you get the leaves, then you get the bulb and the root you can eat as well. And the seeds are useful as well as a herb. So it's like, it's such a good long lasting in the ground crop.
And also just having fennel around, is two other benefits, of course, is the major insectary plant. Excellent for encouraging the beneficials, but also in like syntropic systems, it's a really good biomass plant, like a support, early support plant. So you put it into and just cut it for mulch and just have it there as feeding the soil.
Brilliant.
And then I guess the most interesting thing, but the longest term breeding that I'm doing here, is the perennials. And I'll just rattle them off. There's basically papaya, because I have that same problem I had with the jack bean with papaya. They can grow, but they're slow to mature and very difficult to ripen. So what I've done is I've taken every kind of papaya I can find and basically just trying to cross them. And then also asparagus, also long-term. Just sort of mix them all up. And then the two that are more active is the banana and the sunflower hybrids. So with the bananas, I'm doing some breeding with bananas. So because I'm in New South Wales and I'm in the Kyogle Shire, I'm outside of the banana restriction, the restricted banana growing areas. So where they grow them commercially is where they grow the bananas commercially is in the Richmond Shire. I think it's Lismore, Richmond, Tweed, basically all those coastal local government areas. And I'm in Kyogle, and so we're not restricted. So I can grow these different bananas without having to, you know, report them. So what I'm trying to do is I'm trying to take these polyploid, the bananas that have four sets of chromosomes, and cross them with the diploids.
Oh, so you're recreating the original interspecies hybrid that made the sterile triploids for seedless fruit.
Well, yeah, I mean, it seems to have happened in a few different ways. That is possible. But people, for a long time, people were trying to breed diploids with triploids. So two N crossed with three N. And it's very difficult to get them to actually form seeds.
Yeah.
So you can might do 100 pollinations and get like just a hand, like five seeds. And of those seeds, they're very difficult to germinate. You have to germinate them with in vitro settings.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's very difficult. And then I don't know how sure when it was relatively recently, they found that using the two N crossed with the four N, so that these tetraploids actually produces a whole lot of seed.
Mm.
It's very easy. Like you do a pollination on a bunch and you might get 50 or 60 seeds, and then those will actually can germinate normally.
I am so they said I'm so thrilled to hear that someone is doing that kind of work. I'm just so impressed.
And so, I mean, what they basically said is that the problem has now shifted from how do you get enough seeds to like, how do we get enough land to test all these hybrids? Okay, so they're basically saying you need about 10 acres or something to do. So I'm obviously not going to do that in Australia, but I just thought I would just want to practice here. And what I'm more interested in is the plantains, because I think we have enough good sweet bananas, but spending time in Papua where plantains are really popular, I really developed a liking for boiled. You just boil them up like and eat them like a potato. So, you know, if you had some chili and some boiled banana and some chicken or something, it's a really good meal. And we only have, I think, four or five different types of plantain in Australia. And they all seem to be very susceptible to the weevil.
I tried a couple of them and I was very unimpressed with their performance. And there's like nothing you can do. They're a clone. They're a dead end. They either work or they don't. And you can't apply any of the kind of land racing principles to them.
And you know, like they've found a lot of difficulty in growing bananas, in breeding bananas. And the biggest problem is not the ability to produce them. It's rather the market acceptance. So there's nothing that can really, the market wants a Cavendish. Or it should say the market might desire something other than a Cavendish, but the supermarkets don't want it.
Yeah. It's too much of a risk and a hassle.
So they just want the same type of bananas, same thing with the avocados, just one type. So I think I just want to go completely different. I'm not going for a sweet banana. I want to breed bananas that are for cooking. So I'll basically be able to take the banana, boil it up. Just maybe boil it, fry it, grill it, whatever you want to do like that, and just use it as a starch replacement.
And if you go back to the species bananas, there's a lot of diversity in their cold and dry tolerance, I believe. So you might be on the path to developing plantains that have a much wider range of climates that they can perform well in compared to the imported equatorial kind of plantains.
That's right. The I old think clones. Like where I am
and where you are as well, it's like we're the perfect people to do this on the margins. I mean, if I was down in southern New South Wales or Victoria, it'd be even better because you'd really be breeding for the cool tolerance then. And so I think just whatever I can develop here will be useful to hand on to someone else in the future.
That's what it's all about, isn't it? We can skip forward a couple of questions because I've got a general question at the end about like, how do you hope to pass on the work that you're doing and like make it count to have an impact in the long run? Because there's a lot of like plant collectors and plant breeders out there who do amazing work. And then when they die, the whole collection just kind of collapses in on itself and that's the end of it.
Yeah, I think about that a lot. Yeah. I mean, I've seen it and then I see it happening in the future, you know, if we don't do something about that. And I just saw an article recently how basically saying that plant breeders in general, we're in the last decade, we've lost the numbers of us have gone down significantly. So I think at the moment, we don't have to look too far into the future. We need to be in the immediate. We need to be training more people and encouraging more people. And I think the work that you're doing here and the work, you know, especially like Joseph Loftow's book, I mean, that really, I can see that inspiring a lot of people to just get into it. Because I was going to say, like, how I got into it was you know, first I was doing seed saving with Juliet in Geraldton, and we did it in the very traditional sense where you're trying to keep things separate, trying to maintain your pure lines, and there's always concern about crossing and trying to stop that from happening. And you know how it ends up. You end up with huge amounts of seed, and it's very difficult to keep track of them, and more dies in the seed bank than actually gets carried forward.
Yes, yeah.
But then, you know, just making it accessible to people, getting more people to just have a go. And I think the work we're doing as well is if I can develop these Grexes and then get them adapted to my climate, then I'm able to share them with many more people. So they're not starting from nothing.
Mm.
Because, you know, apart from my lack of access to labor and land, I think the biggest problem is it's very hard to find people to collaborate with when you're right at the beginning.
Yes.
Because it is so speculative, and it's a little bit, you have to be someone who's willing to accept disappointment. It's a lot of what you do will die.
Yes.
Until you start to breed that line, which is it's starting to get some guts to it, then you can share it with people.
What one thing I really have to look into the history of, in the early 1900s in Victoria, there was a community organized poultry breeding program that led to the Australorp chicken, which was like a record-breaking productive bird.
Yeah.
But basically what
That's
they did...
As well.
Yeah, basically what they did is they distributed the labor of doing all of the selection and the breeding and monitoring, but they gave people the tools to make them successful. And then when one person had success, they distributed it to everyone else to like move the project, to ratchet it up to the next level of success. And I really need to dig into the history of that to see if it can be applied to creating community networks of breeding particular crops, like focusing on one thing at a time and making it work.
Yeah, I mean, I think when people, you know, there are easy crops and there are hard crops to get involved in, of course.
And I think things like a pumpkin is something that's, you know, broadly acceptable. A lot of people will try and grow them and be successful with it. And say the seed is easy. So I think, you know, that's like a gateway plant in Australia, particularly pumpkins. Whereas getting someone to get into something like sweet corn breeding is a lot of pitfalls to do with that, with odd genetics and the way that maize can just, you know, like translocate genes across different chromosomes. It can rearrange itself internally.
Mm.
So yeah, it's a little bit complicated, but I think beans and pumpkins, they're probably like what we need to get people doing.
I would see the banana breeding project to be a really great intermediate because they mature a lot faster than a lot of woody tree crops if you were trying to do breeding projects with them. So I don't know, I'm very hopeful that we can, like, between all of us, figure out better strategies to, I mean, we need to breed new plant breeders is I guess,
yes,
the critical thing at the moment, just to bulk up our numbers and create networks of connections.
And, you know, it's hard, especially hard in Australia, as you know, that first of all, we don't have that many people who are doing it. And then those people who are doing it don't have access to many resources.
Mm.
So I feel like what I'm doing here is just building up a pool of resources and basically then it will, you know, I can hand it on to other people to get started a lot more easily.
Mm.
Yeah, because it's taken a lot of hours to collect all these things, you know, you have to go rummaging. It almost gets down to door knocking, doesn't it? Like going around and say, and, you know, looking in backyards and like knock on the front door. It's like, oh, do you mind if I have a few seeds off this vine on your fence?
You've actually just given me an idea that when I finally pull my finger out and do a local bunyanut mass planting, like diverse bunyanut mass planting project in my community, I think it could actually come down to door knocking, like get volunteers together and go door to door and say, can we plant one of these in your backyard or 50 of them or 100 of them if you've got the room?
Well, I know some people who are doing bunyanut planting. They've basically taken upon themselves when they go off to these events and festivals is they'll take some time out and go over and actually do some bunyanut planting out in a ridgeline or somewhere where they're likely to survive, and they'll put little guards around them and just trying to establish these populations of bunya along the ranges.
Yep. Yeah. There was one fun question we skipped over. If you could like wave a magic wand and like create any new like crop or I mean like even livestock species, what would you like, you know, dream into existence?
Okay, so apart from the bananas, which I think are really interesting, but that's already been done, you know, that's not really new, is I think with this entropic agriculture, we really need biomass plants. So we need plants which you cut for mulch, which have a high nutritional value. They're easy to propagate. And so we use this plant called Tithonia diversifolia, which is a Mexican sunflower. And there's a couple of ones that go by that name. But this one is a perennial species, and it's grown by cuttings. And it also produces viable seed. But anyway, it produces just enough viable seed that's considered a weed in many places, because it will get away. And so a sterile version would be really, really handy for our public image. You know, we start introducing weeds to places, they're like, no, you can't do that. You get a bad name. So the thing is, I found this paper where they were able to cross Tithonia rotundifolia, which is the annual species, over on a sunflower. So Helianthus annuum.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So, and it produced seed, and it grew into a plant that was sterile.
Yeah.
Okay. But the problem is both are annuals, so then it died.
Yeah. Yeah.
So what I'm thinking is, like, what if you could cross the sunflower? You just take the sunflower, like a pollenless sunflower, which has no pollen on it, and so it can't cross itself, and then cross it with the Tithonia diversifolia. And then end up with something that has that sort of rooting ability, that perennial ability of its the pollen parent, with it would have two things going for its sterility. It would be an interspecies hybrid, so that already makes it a little bit of a mismatch.
Mm.
And then also the male sterility would carry over from the mother.
Yeah. 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 We've talked about this a little bit before, and it's a project that I'm interested in starting next year. My aim is to develop a perennial oilseed crop that produces lots of like sunflower seeds. But at the same time, if I'm doing that kind of work, I can also be on the lookout or incorporate pathways that are likely to lead to sterile biomass equivalents. So I'm very enthusiastic to help you work on that, and we'll see if we can achieve both opposite outcomes at the same time.
Yeah, opposite outcomes. Yeah, same thing. I have to be like, okay, my reject pool, I'll send that to Shane.
Yeah. If it's producing too many seeds, send it to me. And
it's fully fertile.
And yeah, if I've got ones that grow like crazy, but they can't set seeds, then I'll send them to you. So yeah, there you go.
I also think is really interesting that. Yeah, go on.
Oh, no, sorry. On that topic, before we move on, the thing I would now want to wave into existence would be something like the ice cream beans that I use in the alleys, but a deciduous version. So if you have a crop that grows during the time when it's leafless, it can get enough sunlight without you having to do all of that cutting, that it would actually be just down to timing and selection. And
how long do you need? How long do you need? What period do you need? Of leaflessness.
Oh, it really depends on the crop. But I mean, there's a lot of hot season deciduous legumes from the tropics that come from regions that get really dry for part of the year. If you grew them in an area that didn't get dry, but it still had that timing built into it, that it's like, oh, now's the time of year when I go deciduous, you could sneak in an annual crop or three underneath that canopy at just the right time. Like the bluebells that come up in England before the canopy leaves out. They've got that window where they can grow vigorously in the understory.
Well, I get to experience that quite a lot because, for example, I use Mombasa grass in the syntropic agriculture as a mulch plant. Now, in the tropics, it's just nonstop all year growing.
Mm.
And, you know, you have to cut it if you don't cut it every 6 weeks, it gets out of hand.
Mm.
So a lot of biomass production. But in the subtropics, it'll stop growing between March and October.
Mm.
And so that means I've got these lovely inter-rows to grow winter crops down in between, and the grass is just sitting there and either not growing at all or growing very, very slowly.
Mm.
So you can exploit these differences with photoperiod and you know, things that don't grow as vigorously in a colder area, you can use it to your advantage in that way.
Interesting.
And so what you said about some plants, so many. I mean, if you get into this game, you'll never be bored. You'll never run out of options. There's a plant that I'm using in Papua, which is there's two plants. One is ironwood and the other one is Pacific rosewood or Pterocarpus indicus. Now that's a really good one for like alley cropping because it's like an emergent strata plant and it pollards very, very well and strongly nitrogen fixing.
Mm.
And you can just insert a stick into the ground and it will grow.
Mm.
So
in Papua, but maybe not here.
Not here, but you know, like if you can find,
you've got to find
maybe
the equivalent.
Maybe not down to where we are, but maybe like in north, if you're in the drier parts of northern Australia, it will probably become more deciduous and you could use it there. You could exploit that weakness to in a positive way
because
it does go deciduous in the dry season.
the idea of biomass plants that can be harvested without tools would be really interesting as well. Like if they have a structural weakness in their stem, that you can just snap them by hand. And I mean, plants like cassava are kind of brittle like that. I mean, even cassava could be bred rather than as a tuber crop, as a non-tuberous biomass plant, because it's a big genus and there's lots of hybridization potential there.
Well, this is something I look for when I'm assessing like new weeds and wild plants to use in these centrotropic systems, is that ease of management. So for example, I had to reject Acacia medenii, which was growing locally here, because when I try and cut it with machete, the machete will kind of like deflect off it.
Mm-hmm.
It's very springy and not very brittle. It kind of tends to bend and you know, snap back. And so that's a not very good character for a biomass plant. What you want is what you said, something that's brittle, something you can just go up and go crack it. And so like, if you don't have a knife, it's not going to be an impediment to you actually doing some management work. If you had to have bare hands, you could still do it.
Pigeon pea would be a good example of a legume that has really good brittleness. You can just snap the stems for most of their growth cycle.
Pigeon pea, the tithonia, crotalaria is another one, which has got a nice brittleness to it. Certain salvias as well. You could just snap them off and then break them up, and they're a joy to work with. And different types of cassava. So you've got the cassava, the edible one, then you also got this other one called rubber, which is Glaciovii. It's from the dry areas of Brazil. It's a much bigger plant. And we use that in Papua. It sort of grows wild there. So we use that as initial canopy and also, for mulch. And it produces quite a lot of mulch. It's good.
That's brilliant. We'll wrap up with the final couple of questions. So what is your final message to people who are thinking about getting into crop breeding and this kind of world and this work?
Well, I think we've gone through like the trough, right? We've gone through the area where we're becoming more and more rare. And I think because of the work you're doing here, actually you're opening the doors to many more people. And also with the internet, you know, you've got groups that you can join. You know, you're not like... You and I have come through a period where we had to go through the wilderness, right? It was very hard to find information. You know, it was the pre-digital age. So I think, get involved in it with networks of people. You'll find people very supportive. I mean, we love to see more people getting into this. So, you know, you're going to be supported. So start with easy crops and practice. And if you don't know what the easy crops are, then go back to point one. Ask the network, what should I start with? Because they'll know. They'll try them.
Brilliant.
And I think, you know, buy a few books, join a group and get started.
That's really all there is to it. And the sooner you start, the more you can achieve, because we've all Absolutely. Only got so many growing seasons in us.
Yeah, you're quickly going to come run into the problem where you find you want to do too much. I mean, I'm trying to do too much, but I'm doing too much strategically because I'm trying to generate these grexes so that I can get them out to other people. Because I just feel like beginners not necessarily going to be able to do this.
Yeah,
because I've got a little bit of insider knowledge. So it's like, get them together, mix them up, run them through a couple of cycles, and then get them out to the people with something that's actually usable, not going to be too disappointing for them.
I have exactly the same philosophy that, that early hump of getting the diversity together and making it mix is, depending on the species, it can be quite easy. But for other ones, you really have to get inside the psychology of the plant and pull a few tricks to get all the stars lined up. And sometimes just being patient. Like every year is a little bit different. The flowering periods shift back and forth. Some years are disasters. Other years, things just grow like crazy. And often it takes a few years before you kind of get through those boundaries and start that explosion of hybrid diversity.
Like year one, you're just babying
the existing genetics. And you really have to coddle them a bit just to get them to cross. And then the second year, you may or may not have succeeded, you know, in creating some of these hybrids. You might start to see some vigor. And then the third year is really apparently, you know, mostly when it comes together.
Yeah.
It could take longer, but let's say by the third year, you're starting to see some results of your efforts.
And a final end plug opportunity, how can people get in touch with you or learn more about your work?
Well, the best way to come and see what I'm doing is just to go on Instagram, because that's sort of the main portal, public portal. And my username is revel_saw. And that's where you'll see what I'm doing in Papua and also at my place. And then I'll be teaching a permaculture skills course in Sumba. the island of Sumba in Indonesia from December 27th till January 5th at Ngalung Kala Surf and Eco Retreat. But I'll put some info on that on the Instagram later on when we have the flyers up.
Brilliant. And I'll put links for all of this in the show notes too.
Cool. Now, there was one question you normally ask, which is like, if you could work wonders with any species, what would you create?
Oh, no, I did ask that one. You said you wanted more biomass species.
Ah, so yeah. Sorry, no, that one. I think that's a micro wonder. A macro wonder would be ginger seed.
Ah, ginger. Restoring fertility to ginger.
I've been through all the literature I can find. I cannot find any single reference to ginger seed ever being created.
Interesting.
So I mean, I've collected four different types of ginger now, and I will try and cross-pollinate them. But it's like, this is just like garlic. It's one of those plants that's been cultivated for like 5,000 years or something.
Yeah.
And it's just mostly lost its ability, and it has all sorts of problems. So yeah, I think that's ginger is the one which I will just wonder about all the time. It's like, can it even produce seed?
I think,
and
now you know that family, the pollen is really perishable. So the idea of storing it in the freezer doesn't work. I ran into the same problem with canna. So you have to line up the flowering, but I think it shouldn't be that hard for ginger. You might need to delay certain clones, like keep them in a pot dry and like, but they germinate, they start sprouting even though they're dry. There's got to be some way of like tinkering with the flowering times if they don't line up, but I'm guessing they probably will overlap because they flower.
They'll probably line up.
Yeah.
Like I've got the common ginger, and then I've got a couple other clones that I've found within Australia. Mm. And then I got hold of the red ginger recently, which is
the
variety rubrum.
Oh, okay.
That's this is actually a red skin ginger. It's a smaller variety. I got it through an Indonesian person, immigrant, and they were selling some pots of it. And so I was like, yep, snap that up.
We're so lucky to have that Asian community in Australia. They managed to get all sorts of interesting things growing in their gardens.
Yep. It's essential work.
Would you consider any interspecies crosses with the semi-edible gingers? Because there's a lot of gingers that are used in like little pockets of ethnic communities as flavoring agents, but they've got very different flavors.
I think I would. And also I think there might be one of them around already. One of these other sort of semi-ginger, not like ginger, not quite ginger. There's this one up in North Queensland that gets handed around, and the people call it lemon ginger.
Mm.
And it looks very, very similar to the true ginger, but it's much more vigorous, and its flavor is not as strong, but it's got the vigor. So perhaps, yeah, if you cross that with something that was strong in flavor but weak in vigor, you might get something usable.
And there's the Japanese Myoga ginger that we mentioned as well too. That's usually flower buds are eaten, I believe. So yeah, lots of so many possibilities there. Like once you crack open a genus, and then even intergenerate crosses, like the combinations and permutations that you can stack on top of each other, it's just it's mind-boggling.
Yeah, and then also people shouldn't leave themselves limited to food either. There's also essential oils, medicinal uses, and then like I was talking with the sunflower hybrids before, the cut flower industry uses so many sunflowers, and the seed is quite expensive. So imagine if you could produce a clone which was it was reliable every year. Mm-hmm. You just have to grow the from cutting. Yeah, I mean a florist would love that. So
phony amass flowers around Mother's Day here, like every year, like it's
acres
of gold.
And there's such a variation in even the wild populations in flower size as well.
Mm-hmm.
So some have very small flowers, and some is like dinner plate size.
Wow.
So, yeah, I think I'm going to pursue that, and I encourage anyone else to as well. This is an open source project. Please like go for it.
Well, on that hopeful note, I think we'll wrap it up here. Thank you very much for taking the time to talk to us. And I suspect that I would enjoy talking to you for another hour in the future. So if you're willing to come back next year, I would love to have a chance to chat again.
Absolutely.
If you want your vegetables to have a genuine zest for life, then Joseph Lofthouse's book, Landrace Gardening, is for you. Here's what readers are saying. A short, inspiring, informative read that blew my mind at least once per chapter. Everything is far more productive and delicious than ever before. The best book I've read on gardening in ages. Get your copy of Landrace Gardening now and start growing locally adapted varieties.